Raymond Scott was a composer, inventor, and pioneer of electronic music, and an American original. After his death in 1994, Raymond's son, filmmaker Stan Warnow, decided to investigate his estranged father's life, and he's made a documentary called Deconstructing Dad, The Music Machines and Mystery of Raymond Scott. It opens today at the Quad Cinema, and I'm very pleased it has brought Stan Warnow to our show today. Hello.
Hello. It's wonderful to be here, and thank you for having me.
How well did you know your father before you decided to make this film about him?
Well, you know, of course, I grew up with him for a while, but I have to say that I never really knew him that well in the way that most sons know their fathers, because his total concentration was on his work. You know, like so many people who are highly accomplished, he was obsessed with his work. And not only that, he was kind of uncomfortable as a father. He really didn't even want children. My mom says in the film he didn't think he could handle it. So he was never really that comfortable around us. So I have to say I didn't know him that well.
And then he divorced your mother.
How old were you
at the time?
I was about 10 when he divorced my mother, but he had been already out of the house for a couple of years.
How did your dad first start playing music?
Well, he started playing music because his father owned a music store in Brooklyn. And my dad discovered the player piano at around the age of 2, and he started following along with the player piano. And that's how he first learned the piano. And maybe that's a reason he was so in love with the technology of music, because that was part of his introduction to it.
And then when did he start composing? How old was he?
Well, I think he started composing quite young, and then he started working at CBS when he was in his early 20s and began composing a lot more then. And after a few years, they let him compose and develop his own group.
And he also was just recording stuff. He was one of those people who liked to record street sounds and extraneous conversation.
Yes, he recorded everything throughout his life.
So was he inventing musique concrète before?
He did do musique concrète in the 50s, certainly, and his music was representational all along. It was what can be called programmatic music or descriptive music, and so he was often describing things like a fleet of taxi cabs, confusion among a fleet of taxi cabs on meeting a fair, war dance for wooden Indians, dinner music for a pack of hungry cannibals, all descriptive kinds of compositions.
Another wonderful title, Boy Scout in Switzerland.
Yes, yeah, that's a good one too, yes.
That we opened with Powerhouse, one of his most famous compositions.
Yes, yes, definitely.
And it doesn't sound like a powerhouse.
Well, you know, if you listen to the beginning, those extended sounds, to me, I think this is what he meant them to be, was that they're the turbines kind of whirring up at the beginning. The middle section, Powerhouse B, which you played, which is the most iconic, and that's the one people usually instantly recognize from cartoons. I'm not sure what that represents.
Now, it's often called jazz, but he did not compose jazz.
Yeah, what he did, as somebody says very eloquently in the film, Wayne Barker is a pianist in a tribute group, the Raymond Scott Orchestrette. What he did was he used jazz sounds, jazz techniques, but he did let his musicians improvise when they were working up a piece, but when he heard what he liked, he would go, that's it. Play it that way every time, which his musicians didn't much like.
Because they were jazz musicians.
They were jazz
musicians.
They were used to improvising. They wanted to improvise, yeah.
But they stayed with him for a long time because the money was good?
I think so. You know, as one of them wrote later on, we were all like unhappy, but the records were selling like crazy.
Was that from the start?
Yes, yes. From the very first time they were on the air, like the switchboards lit up or whatever they did back then, and people were calling in and they were really reacting well to the music. And when my father wrote it, he said, I want to write music that people like the first time they hear it. And that was true.
And this is in the 30s.
This is in the mid-30s.
When the quintet was featured in movies, the camera did close-ups on all the other members of his group. But your father was... I don't know if there was ever a close-up of your father.
No, there wasn't, except for the one I created by zooming in the film, as you saw, because I think he may have wanted it that way. It's a big irony, and his life is full of irony and paradox. And one of those things is he was in show business, but he didn't like being the center of attention. And I imagine he was like, no close-ups. Or who knows? Or maybe he was such a pain that they didn't want to give him close-ups. I really don't know.
Well, you went out there, obviously, had to find a lot of footage. Is it readily available?
Well, the movies are mostly readily available. Yeah, you know, they're out and around commercially. You know, as DVDs on YouTube. There are many, many excerpts on YouTube as well.
Well, many people are familiar with your father's music through Warner Brothers cartoons. How did they come to be used as the backgrounds of Bugs Bunny, Porky Pig, Wile E. Coyote, the Roadrunner, and all those others?
Yeah, well, that's another one of those paradoxes, because my dad never wrote music for cartoons. He wrote music that was very well suited for cartoons. And the music director at Warner Brothers, named Carl Stalling, a legendary figure in the animation world, and now my father is to some extent too, he must have really liked my father's music, and they licensed it. But as far as we know, the two of them never met. My father was never consulted. Warner Brothers just re-recorded it with their own orchestra.
And did he ever say anything about the use of them in the cartoons?
Not that my sister or I remember.
Although, you
know,
it sure did spread the word.
Yeah. No, I remember my mom telling me when I was on the way to the theater on a Saturday when I was a kid that you're going to see your father's music in this cartoon. But he never talked about it. And when it came up with his third wife, she said he hadn't ever mentioned it to her. And she brought it up because the music was being licensed for Ren and Stimpy, a modern show. And all he said to her is, oh, that was a long time ago.
But he was still getting royalties.
He was getting royalties. I'm sure he liked that part of it.
Raymond Scott's wide range of music attracted fans, ranging from Shirley Temple to Michael Jackson. His son, Stan Warno, is here to teach us more about his father. He's made a documentary called Deconstructing Dad, which opens today. Your father was Jewish, born Harry Warno.
Yes.
Was he religious?
No, not at all.
He had a nose job when he was fairly young. Was he embarrassed about being a Brooklyn Jew?
I think he was to some extent. He really kind of tried, just basically turned his back on his culture, which is something that bothers me. But at that time, a lot of people did that. People wanted to assimilate.
On the other hand, talk about assimilation. When he became music director at CBS Radio, he integrated the station's, the network's orchestra.
Yes.
And hired some pretty great musicians. Ben Webster?
Who else? Yeah, Ben Webster, Cozy Cole, Charlie Shavers, Trummy Young, you know, really first rate, like the best musicians in the country. And he had left CBS and they wanted him back, and that was a condition, and he kind of fought with them and they finally gave in, and I'm very proud of him for that.
Well, for a guy who didn't want to write jazz, he hired some of the greatest jazz improvisers ever.
He did love jazz. And at one time, he was in this group in the early years on CBS called the Saturday Night Swing Session, where they would swing. And he admired Duke Ellington tremendously. It's just that he was incredibly controlling. And when he heard what he liked, that's what he wanted. I think he thought, well, they'll never do it better than that, so I want them to do it that way every time. But he did love jazz. Another paradox.
What came first, Dorothy Collins or his involvement with electronic music?
Oh, let's see. He was always involved in electronics from, you know, in the recording process. So I would say that came first. But in the mid-40s, he had an idea for a machine. What was it called? The orchestra machine. And it was a sampling type machine, except he wanted to use tape loops for it. So that was...
Well, tape was just becoming available.
Yeah. I think, you know, maybe even in the mid-40s, it was wire recording still. Mm-hmm. But he had this idea that was later realized in the 60s with the Mellotron. He filed a patent disclosure for it, you know, an intent to build it, but he never did build it.
But using electronic machines, of course, gives you more control over the music that working with musicians doesn't.
Right. I mean, you know, part of it may be that he was so frustrated with the musicians that he wanted to be able to control everything and not have to deal with their personalities. We don't really know. At the same time, he had a lot of admiration for musicians who he really respected. He had a lot of admiration. And I'm named after a saxophonist. I always forget to look up his name. It wasn't Stan Getz, but I'm named after a saxophonist who he really liked.
Not Stan Getz.
Okay. No, not Stan Getz.
Your parents divorced?
My parents divorced.
And eventually your father married Dorothy Collins.
Right. I mean, whole kind of scandalous part of the history, and always something to juice things up a little bit. She had come to live with us as a child. He saw her as having tremendous potential. And in almost as natural a way, as she got to be, you know, a young woman, here was her mentor and her father figure, but he wasn't her father. You know, as you look at the Oedipal side of it, not the Oedipal side, the other side, the female equivalent. it was almost natural that that would have happened, and it did happen. So he ended up leaving my mom and marrying her.
And training her, being a kind of a Svengali.
Yes, absolutely. It was this Svengali kind of thing, and eventually she rebelled.
Well, he made her a star when he was music director of your hit parade from 1949 to 1957.
Yes, he did. I mean, he got her that job, and he kind of crafted her whole image.
And then she became a big enough star to eventually, you say, rebel?
Yes, yes. She became a big star, and I don't really know the details about this, but I think she felt like he was now holding her back.
After a while, he seems to pretty much drop out of the music scene and just get involved with creating machines.
Well, he was creating machines, and, you know, he told me once that, like, up to the age of 55, every time one thing ended, the phone would ring and another thing began, and suddenly at the age of 55, that all stopped. The phone stopped ringing, and he had to scramble, and he loved the electronic music, and he did that. So, but he was sort of like telling me, when we got a little closer, as he and I were both older, he was telling me that one day.
And he seemed to be ahead of everybody else, despite the fact that we don't call it the Scott synthesizer. We call it the Moog synthesizer.
Well, yeah. I mean, it is the Moog synthesizer. Moog was a genius in his own right. My dad had made a keyboard synthesizer of his own about 10 years before Moog's. But it worked very differently. It kind of sounded similar, but it worked differently. And then a fellow by the name of Herb Deutsch approached Moog later. And Moog always saw himself as a toolmaker. And Herb, who's in the film, approached Moog with this idea for a keyboard instrument. And they built that together. But Moog said he was inspired in part by my father's work.
Well, your father always seems to be trying to catch up with the technology. He comes up with a machine, and then transistors come along.
Yeah.
And so he has to change it again. And that happened again and again. Never really built the machine that he fantasized?
Well, he was just, you know, as Alan Entenmann, an engineer who worked on the Electronium, says in the film, he was never finished. He was a true artist. He could never finish. There was always something else he wanted to do. And you're absolutely right that the technology kept changing. So he would want to integrate the newest technology.
Did he spend most of his money on this? Is that why he wasn't
pretty
rich
much
in
all
his later years?
Yeah, pretty much all of his money. You know, he didn't know about saving, although he once told me that when he was in Hollywood, he used to drive through the valley on the weekends, and there were all these orange farms for sale, you know, for $1,000 in the middle of the Depression. And he said if somebody had said you should buy one of those, he would have, but nobody ever said that to him.
There's some interesting people who show up in this story. The Academy Award-winning composer John Williams, Mark Mothersbaugh, the co-founder of the rock group Devo, DJ Spooky, Berry Gordy.
Yeah. Well, Berry Gordy isn't in the film. We couldn't really get
I know, but I mean, he is part of the story.
Yes.
John Williams, because he's the son of somebody who worked for your
father? Right. Johnny Williams, this great drummer who was in my dad's band at the beginning, John Williams is his son. And they moved to California when my dad started appearing in the films. And that's how John Williams ended up growing up out there, because I think Johnny just stayed out there after a while. So, yeah, there's a big connection
there. John Williams has had a nice career as a composer.
Yeah.
Mark Mothersbaugh, because he was inspired by the music.
Yeah, Mark grew up listening to that cartoon music. He really liked it, and you can kind of see that in some of the stylistic elements in Devo. And so he just really liked that music, and then he ended up sort of, he never thought about who wrote it. He said as a young man, and he ended up using Powerhouse in a composition, and then as it became a commercial thing, they said, well, you know, somebody wrote this, and he found out who wrote it. And he found out more about Raymond Scott, and he really identifies with Raymond Scott in a way.
And Berry Gordy actually hired your father to invent a machine that would compose songs? I mean, would Diana Ross have been singing a Raymond Scott machine composed song?
Well, I don't know about that, although there's one Diana Ross song where I kind of think maybe I hear the electronium a little bit. But he didn't hire him to invent that machine. That machine my dad was working on already. Berry Gordy wrote a press release about it, came to see it. And Berry Gordy was always very astute about new technology and trying to have the latest cutting edge things in his studio. So he ended up buying that machine, ordering one that was customized for him, the only one that ever really got built beyond the prototype.
What was Beethoven in a Box?
Well, Beethoven in a Box is just the Chusett, who's in the film, and he's the director of the Raymond Scott Archives. That's just his expression of what that, a nice expression of what that machine could do, could compose.
Beethoven.
Well, it couldn't compose Beethoven, but I heard about a new machine that's computer composer that's composing modern music.
All by itself?
Yeah, in Spain. I was contacted by somebody who saw some of the publicity for the film, and it's very impressive. I'm looking forward to meeting this man, Francisco.
Well, the film ignites interest in your father's music, anybody who sees it.
I hope so.
Are we seeing a resurgence in sales? Is there a Rhino collection?
Well, there is, I think, there's a company, a great company in the Netherlands, because there's actually more appreciation for my dad, at least at the moment, in Europe than here. And they've been putting out his music for quite a while now. And there has been a resurgence. We're hoping there will be even more because, most people still don't know his name. But, I mean, we're all working very hard, and I'm kind of a little late to the party. Some people have been working later than I have to kind of solve that, to cure that that problem.
Well, you say at the start that you made the film partly to get to know your father better.
Yes.
Do you feel you know him better?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've learned so much about his work, that business with the CBS Orchestra and all these things. I had never known that he had invented a fax machine somewhere along the way and a radio scanner. I never knew that. I always thought of him as kind of mechanistic. And in the course of doing my research, I found out that when his second wife, Dorothy, left him, he was just devastated. I mean, I should have realized that, but I kind of never really thought about that. I would see him, and he would seem like the same person he had always been, but inside, he was going through tremendous turmoil. So it really humanized him for me in a way that hadn't existed before.
Stan Warnow's film, Deconstructing Dad, The Music Machines and Mystery of Raymond Scott, opens today at the Quad Cinema. Let's go out with a little of an Arabian house party.
Sounds great. And thank you so much.